Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. We come your way Sundays, 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday mornings at 1 a.m. and we stream live at richarddugan.com. We also archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and we also link to our guests. We'll be giving you the website for our guest here shortly, and we thank you so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way because we can, because we want to try and impart information to you. We lay out a smorgasbord of all kinds of different ideas and concepts so that you can discover new ways of doing the things that you want to do, of finding your life's purpose, of achieving the things that you want, of drawing to you the types of people and circumstances in your life. And I think that today will be no exception to that rule. We have in studio with us, and I love it when we have folks in studio. We have in studio the author of her latest work, Writing for Bliss. It's a 7-step plan for telling your story and transforming your life. Right up our alley here on Tell Me Your Story. And it is Diane Rabth, PhD. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
You also, in addition to having this particular book with the 7 steps, as it were, but you also hold classes on a regular basis or workshops throughout the country. And so you do a lot of traveling.
I do a fair amount of traveling, yes. I do a lot in California, but I do a lot of traveling, yes.
And when you travel, you meet all kinds of people. And there are some people who, it may be just in your day-to-day, not so much at the workshops, that you might get into conversation with who they really don't think that their life, let me put it this way. I've often said that if my life were a reality show, and bear in mind, I don't watch reality shows, I wouldn't watch it because it ain't that interesting. Now, it is to me. But, and when I share parts of my life and my life story with people, they're amazed and astounded and this and that. To me, it's, but that's just my life. And do you run into that a lot where people just don't feel like what they have gone through and experienced is really that significant that other people would really want to hear about it?
Well, that's an interesting question, actually. There are people that have stories that they want to tell. They're just very compelled to tell it, and they will do anything to get it on paper and share it with others. And there are other people, like you say, that do not think they have a story to tell. But I believe everybody has a story to tell. I believe we all have had, dramas and things that happen in our lives that are interesting that can help other people understand their own lives. So, yes, there are people. There are people that don't want to write either. And there are people that don't want to write, but I inspire them to write because they have interesting stories to tell. Yes.
It is also one of those things where I started journaling at the age of 21. Now, I haven't journaled for a long time. I have 4, 5, 6 of those blank books filled. Okay. One side of the page. I didn't want to really mess up the contours of the page more than they already were by the heavy writing. And I go back and I read it sometimes and I'm going, are you kidding me? Really? That's what you wrote? But then I have to realize, and that's where I was at that time in my life. Mm-hmm. And it's how I became the person I am today. And I can't, is that another aspect of this in terms of being honest and truthful? Because sometimes I would sit there and I would want to journal and I'd want to say something, but I would think, but what if somebody gets a hold of this? I don't know if I'm ready to have people. So I'm gonna start editing even as I'm writing. Do you find that people have trouble doing that in terms of being honest and truthful in that regard?
Well, you've actually lumped 3 really good questions in your comment. So I'll start with the first one.
That's pretty typical of me, I guess.
Well, no, I think that's brilliant. I mean, it means that you've read the book, you understand what's going on, and so I appreciate that. So the first one is old journals and going back and looking at them. Yeah. And I'm a big advocate of keeping old journals, but it's really important when you are journaling to date your journals so that when you go back, you say, oh, yes, I remember when I was like that in 2001.
Every page in my journal or every entry, I put the date. That's always the first thing.
Perfect. Well, then you're a natural.
Then I should get back at it.
Yeah, get back at it, yeah. And then in going over old journals, a lot of people don't go back to the old journals and look at them like you have. But what I do suggest, especially for writers who are looking for material to write about, is I suggest going back and circling or highlighting items that still resonate with you, whether it's love, loss, certain feelings that you have over and over again, because that means that there's possibly a gold mine of material there for you to even dig deeper into.
Mm-hmm.
So now what was the second comment?
Well, it had to do with people being honest about their journal entries. And in my case, it was, what happens if my mother, my father, my brothers and sisters, my friends, if somehow the Russians hacked into it and put it up on the internet or WikiLeaks?
Yeah.
And it is handwritten. It is not digital.
Richie Leaks.
There you go. That would be mine. But what about that?
Yeah, well, people ask that question very often because they're afraid if they pour their heart into their journal and someone finds it. But I'm a big advocate of just writing and just writing without fear. And there's a big chapter in my book about having the courage to write, because it's one thing getting it on paper and then what do you do with it after? And I think, I had an interesting thing happen to me when I was working on one of my first books. It was a memoir about my grandmother who committed suicide. And after she died, I found her journals. And in her journals, I learned that she was actually divorced from my grandfather and they were living in the same house for many years.
Oh, wow.
Which I guess in the 60s perhaps was more common because divorce wasn't as acceptable.
Yeah.
And so it's not that I thought differently of her. I mean, it was kind of shocking, but it gave me another dimension. It was interesting to read. And I actually loved just having something in my hand that told me about her. It was a gift.
Yeah.
So even if you're revealing things that you think might be hurtful or to your family, I think it's better than nothing.
What do you think about the comparison between actually physically taking a writing instrument in hand and, as I did with the blank book, writing it down physically, as opposed to in the 21st century, people are actually now starting to video journal, if you will. And what I'm leading into is the internal impact of this process of putting whether you're journaling or you're actually writing down your memoirs, although I'm not sure what the difference is. Maybe we can talk about that too. But in terms of I've talked with people who we've discussed this whole the impact on the brain, the impact on the heart in terms of, your soul, and that more esoteric impact of writing your story or journaling and what have you.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, there have been studies saying that, you get more into your emotional truth, you get more into your heart center when you're using actually a writing instrument, whether it's a pen or pencil, in your journal as opposed to the computer. But I know a lot of people that have trouble writing. They don't like their handwriting. They can't reread it. And so they prefer journaling online or verbally. And that's fine, too. I think we have to all find what works best for us. Mm-hmm. There's no cookie-cutter way to do it. These are just suggestions. Most of my books, and this is my ninth book, have begun in my journals, and you mentioned I travel a lot, so I do a lot of writing in the airplanes, and often I'll have the first chapter written in my journal or a poem or an essay because I feel like I'm more creative with a pen or pencil.
Mm-hmm.
And then I continue on my computer.
Plus, you also know how to write cursive
or
block, either way. But most people nowadays, the young folks, what's that?
They're not even learning it in school anymore. It's insane.
Well, I was thinking about that as I was coming in to do the interview. I was thinking, I remember how in high school, I made it a point that one of the classes I was going to take was typing, because I wanted to learn how to touch type, which I can do now. I'm not that fast, but I'm fast enough for me. It works. And so I made it a point to do that. And then I'm hearing the stories today here in 2015, 16, 17, 18, what have you, in the 21st century, where they're not even teaching cursive in school anymore. They're not even teaching them how to write their letters and numbers and so forth. It's all keystrokes. And that's a conversation we've had as well in reference to, and I've talked with people who are involved. One gentleman, lives the monastic life. He's a guru, if you will. Swami Vididishananda. He's with a fellowship that resides up on the hill in Montecito, and he travels to England where they have a school and they teach Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. And the importance is that what it does is it starts to change the brain and the synaptic pathways, and so forth, getting people to process information differently. And I'm not exactly how to put it. So I'm just wondering about that aspect of physically writing versus typing and or verbally doing it, how that will assist someone in this process, as you talk about, of transforming their lives.
Yeah, I think also the other thing, and there is a chapter in my book on letter writing. I think there's a little bit of a resurgence into letter writing. In addition to having that synapsis and that connection between the hand and the brain, it also slows us down when mm-hmm. we're writing longhand. And I think we're leading such a fast-paced life. And, you know, I think it's very valuable. I actually write all my thank you notes by hand. I try not to use, you know, email. And it really doesn't take that much longer, just a thank you note. But it's the penmanship, which is, you know, wonderful. Last year, I had a memorial for my dear friend Thomas Steinbeck, and his father, John Steinbeck, used to use pencils, and he used to use like 100 a day when he was writing his books. And one of the people that was at the memorial has a company called Blackwing Pencils. And as a gift of thanks for having the memorial, he sends me every month a box of pencils.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and just to the ritual of sharpening a pencil, you know, having the eraser, writing, and they really do last long in books. People are afraid to use pencils because they don't think they'll last, but it does last. But it's just, first of all, Blackwings, I'm not advertising for them. I don't have any stocks in them, but they're not those pencils where you mentioned about pressing hard on your page. You press very lightly and you get a fabulous impression. And it just really, it slows you down. It's an art. Handwriting is an art.
With an eraser on the end?
Yes, with an eraser on the end.
Oh, my God.
And I started taking calligraphy course also, just, you know, because I write poetry, and I thought it would be nice to just write some gifts for people in calligraphy. So penmanship is an art, and a lot of people, like you said, do not like, you know, their handwriting. And I think it's very sad that they don't teach it in the schools anymore.
I went through a personal growth program back in the late 80s, early 90s, and we had to handwrite whatever it was we were supposed to write, and then we're supposed to exchange it with our dyad partner. And I remember this was really kind of an unusual experience, and this has to do with the response of my partner in this exercise, who, because I wrote it in print, I printed it, okay? I didn't do cursive. And she brought that up during the exercise in front of the whole group, that she thought that I would, you know, she made whatever comments she made, to which the facilitators then jumped all over her for making any kind of a judgment about the way in which I had written what I had written. You know, and I kind of felt bad for her, you know, in one sense. But I actually stood up and I explained to her, and obviously the whole room, the reason I did that was so you'd be able to read it. Because if I had done it in longhand, odds are you would have not been able to read it. So I did it. There was an intent in that respect. I wanted to make sure that she knew what the heck I was talking about.
Sure.
And again, so like you say, there are people who, you know, I should have been, I have been given the moniker. I have no PhD. I have no medical degree, but they call me Dr. D. So I'm the audio physician. Okay? It's just a thing that has happened, right? With my handwriting, cursive, I should have been a doctor.
You're right, because in my past life I was an RN, and they really cannot write. It's like, what did you want us to do with this patient?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the old prescription pads and how they did
it. Scribbles.
What? I'm sorry. What's it say?
They must.
And you give it to the pharmacist, and he can interpret it. It's like, really?
Yeah.
You know, what school did you go to be able to read that? You know, did you go to hieroglyphics? You know. Oh, it's amazing. And maybe there's the code right there. Yeah. I was actually watching a movie, The Kingsman. Mm-hmm. And it had Samuel L. Jackson as the villain. And he's sitting in this old car, maybe 1920s, 30s car, and he's leaning back. He's wearing a top hat and all this. And he's writing with a pencil or a pen on a legal pad. And he turns to the gal who's sitting next to him and he says, "This is the only form of communication that can't be hacked." And I thought, wow, that's true.
Yeah.
Nobody can get to it. And I thought about that in terms of the journals that I have in a container under the house right now. What about also, does drawing and or, I'm going to use the term doodling, adding artwork, if you will, of what value or of what significance is that in someone doing the memoirs or the journaling and this kind of thing, telling their story in that regard?
Well, they're very valuable. If that's something that compels you, again, go for it. You know, I taught a course once on, I collaborated with a visual artist. And so she would have them draw a picture on the left side of the journal, and then I would have them write about it on the right side. So for some people, the visual art can bring out words as well, mm-hmm. and that's what we were encouraging. I do, people ask me what I do in my spare time. Well, I meditate about an hour a day, but I also do mandalas. I color them.
Oh, very cool. And I've seen those books.
They're kind of the trend right now. You go to the bookstores, wow. Are on all the tables. Yeah. And I think not only does it slow us down, but I find that I'm able to tap into my creativity in that way. So I don't really doodle very well, but you do those very well. I used to love Carl Lungbix as a kid. So, but sure, anything that, you know, because when you're doodling, I imagine you're tapping into something subconscious in your brain.
Yeah.
And so it might elicit some thoughts which you might want to write about, for sure. Yeah, definitely a good combination.
Yeah. And it's also said too, because I think this does apply, maybe not, having a pad and pen or a pencil or what have you, or some type of recording device, when you wake up from a dream, and writing that down, because that's part of you too. That's part of your memoirs, if you will. That's of your life.
It's your subconscious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I used to, when I teach journaling, I used to tell everyone, have a journal at your bedside, have one in your purse if you're a woman, have one in your back pocket if you're a guy, have it in the car, have it, you know, everywhere, because you never know when the muse is going to arrive. But life gets complicated having all those. But I still, so now I suggest definitely a journal at the bedside that you just keep there, and mm-hmm. then one other journal. And yes, writing first thing in the morning is very powerful. I had a dream. I just put my mother in an assisted living facility, and I had a dream the other night. And this was so vivid. She was there was a doctor laying on a hospital bed with round, he was all in white, wireframe glasses. And he lifted his head up and he said, "You know, your mother wants to pass away, but she doesn't know how to do it."
Uh-huh.
And she was kind of she was like an angel kind of floating around the room. It was really bizarre. And I just wondered, of course, if that was a message. And I called her, and she actually wasn't feeling very well that day.
Mm.
So I think if we listen to, not all of us remember dreams very vividly, but if we listen to the dreams, they could elicit some interesting information for us. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember, and it was an audible dream. There was I can't recall any visuals to it that came to mind when my second wife and I went to Ireland, and we went out to the Aran Islands off the west coast of Galway, and we were walking through this. It was like the cemetery or the what have you of the seven churches, something along those lines. And, you know, we were looking at this and that and the other thing and taking pictures. And she came over to me. My wife came over to me and says, "You need to come over here and see this." Now, I had told her the story of the dream. And she took me over and she says, "Look at the tombstone." And it was a flat on the ground tombstone. And I read the name on the tombstone. Now, the dream was that my best friend, my dear friend, who he passed away in our home the year before. Oh. As a matter of fact, the 10th of October
Oh my gosh.
Of 2003. And in the dream, which was audible, he said, just don't say anything bad in front of Bridget. And so there we are in front of this tombstone. And I look down at the name. Now, my wife's last name is McDonough. And the name on the tombstone was Bridget McDonough. I kid you not,
spooky.
I put my hand over my mouth and I walked away.
Oh, of course I would do the same. Oh, my goodness.
Not going to say anything bad for Bridget. And it's, you know, it was just amazing. Just, it's like, whoa, what, you know, what?
What do you get to think about that?
Yeah. You know, and then, of course, and even right now, I'm thinking, okay, we weren't having, she and I were not having any issues or difficulties on the trip. I mean, it was just a wonderful day, and we didn't have any underlying tensions or anything like this. It was just a great day. And I'm thinking, what would I have said bad?
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it was very interesting. This process, and by the way, speaking of mandalas and so forth, I don't draw mandalas, but it's something different, something similar. Mm-hmm. I do this large shape that's empty in the center, and then I just start doing crisscross lines.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I'm done, I start coloring in the spaces mm-hmm. that the lines have made, always making sure never to put the same shade of color next to each other.
Interesting.
I don't know what the heck that means, but that's sort of my form of meditation of sorts.
Yes, that's wonderful, you know? That you do that.
And in the past, I've even done a sort of a comic book kind of I'll get a coloring pad, drawing pad, and I'll start a story. You know, one of my favorite shows back when I was a kid was Lost in Space, and mm-hmm. so I started to. So one page is they're doing this, and then the next page is they're doing some. It's not a flip book. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, those kinds of things. But I don't ever recall ever putting any dialogue. You know, it was just the images that were important. And so this sort of goes into that aspect of writing about what you remember. And I find this fascinating with people who write about actual events. I remember thinking about this when I was reading Autobiography of a Yogi back when I was 17, 18, and I'm still rereading it. And the question that came to me was, the guy lived a long life. Mm-hmm. How does he remember all these little details? And so I'm wondering about that in terms of, for example, you say you've written your memoirs or parts thereof. I find it funny when someone writes their memoirs and maybe they're in their 20s or their 30s or their 40s.
Yeah, very few people can do that.
It's like, wait a minute. Have you lived long enough to even have memoirs? Yeah. But in terms of the details, and here's the interesting part. When I was a child growing up, my mother would always, almost every morning before we went off to school, great breakfast and all this, and a teaspoon of cod liver oil.
Oh, yes, I remember.
But my mother does not remember that. I don't know whether it's because she's blocking it for some reason. I don't know. But I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm going to put something like that in my memoirs.
The taste is very memorable,
by the
way.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to put that in my memoirs. And my other siblings may or may not, they say, I don't know what you're talking about. That never happened. But those are my memories.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a place where I need, not I personally, but we need to get to, mm-hmm. if we're going to journal, if we're going to write, if we're going to tell our story, regardless of whether it's going to be published and made available to the public, where those are the things I remember, whether or not anybody else remembers them, mm-hmm. or for that matter, they were true or not. For whatever reason, I'm remembering those details.
Yeah, and actually, that's a very important point and a very large part of my book and a big chapter. It's called Writing Your Emotional Truth. Only you can write your own emotional truth, and we all see things differently. There's and there's nothing wrong with it, and there's no right and wrong. It's just, you know, you can grow up in the same house with a sibling and they see things totally different about your parents' relationship, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Tobias Wolff wrote a book called This Boy's Life, and his brother wrote a book, his brother Jeffrey wrote a book called The Dukes of Deception. And they were both separated from their parents. Their parents separated when they were young, and one went to live with one parent, one went to live with the other. But their memoirs are so totally, have totally different viewpoints of the parents' situation. And so, and that's fine. It's beautiful. And we were all different. We all, so the important thing when you're writing is not to think about your readers, not to think about your family. It's just to write from your heart, write your own emotional truth and how you see things. And memory, you brought up the whole thing about cod liver oil, and which is, it just elicited, I suddenly tasted it in my mouth because I was like one of those kids that always had it too. And I thought, oh, and I will ask my mother if she remembers. I don't know if she does. But what fascinates me about that is what do we remember, what don't we remember?
Yeah.
I mean, we all, and that's what's beautiful, that we all remember different things about different stories. And so that's why writing is so great, because it can bring out all those memories that are inside you.
When we come back from our break, I want to talk about some of the steps, but I also want to talk about, and dovetailing off of what you've just said, about the process of getting into, shall we say, that state of really opening yourself up and then starting to put it down on the page. And I highly recommend, as you've already stated, that to you, the listener, you get paper and pen or pencil. Mm-hmm. Crayon, don't care, big lump of coal, whatever it takes to put down what it is that you want to talk about. By the way, the website in regards to a writing for Bliss and the other 8 books that she has, another one I want to talk to you about too is Writing on the Edge. Diana Rabb is the website, dianarabb.com. That's dianarabb.com. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. We'll be right back.
Stories, I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Diana Rabb, a PhD. What is the PhD in?
It's in psychology.
Okay.
And my actual research, I'm not a clinical psychologist, I'm a research psychologist, but because I've been writing for over 50 years, my dissertation was on the healing and transformative powers of memoir writing, which is what inspired this book, in fact.
Wow. I took psychology in college, junior college back in Phoenix. I loved the course because of the things that I learned. I didn't do well in the course.
About yourself or about others?
A little of both. I probably learned even more when I went through these personal growth programs. Mm. The one I went through in the 80s was LifeSpring,
okay,
similar to EST. Didn't go through EST, but it was great fun on the one hand in terms of the things that I discovered about myself that were hard to discover. And what I found was still that same intrusion of the ego saying, look, you don't need to go quite that far. I see all the other people going nuts, and they're over there laughing, and they're crying, and they're emoting, and they're angry, and they're beating up the pillows and all this. You just calm down. You don't need. And, boy, they called me out just about every time. They knew when you weren't genuine. They knew when you weren't really being honest with them, let alone yourself. So let's talk about, first of all, let's talk about the steps.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
The 7 steps in this regard to writing for Bliss, a 7-step plan for telling your story and transforming your life. Where do we start?
Well, we start with wanting to write, for one.
Okay.
And we start by the preparation to write. Now, in order to write creatively, it's good to have a sacred space, whether it's, you know, in a garden, at a park, or at your own desk, in a library, in a bookstore, find a place that you feel comfortable to write. And then you have to get all your materials ready, get the pens that you like, the paper that you like. I've been using fountain pens lately. I love the flow.
Oh, I love fountain pens. They are so cool. That little point,
mm-hmm,
and now I prefer the one where you stick the cartridge in rather than dip it in the inkwell.
I agree. Yes, much less messy. And actually, I've discovered clickable fountain pens by Pilot, and they're brilliant because
beats a quill. Let me tell you.
Oh yes.
What is it? A peacock feather or something like that?
Yeah. Exactly. So find what works for you. If that is too complicated, I like the gel pens. Those are great too.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So remember the Bic pens?
I do.
Yeah, though I find those really hard to write with. They just don't flow as well.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I don't even know if they make them anymore. But.
I think, though, that it's also that sense of the ink is like right there. I mean, yeah, okay, with the Bic, with the ball, you know, it's rolling around, what have you. But I don't know. It's like you want the words to flow out of you. You've got the ink that's kind of doing the same kind of thing. And there's that plus the feel of the writing instrument.
Yes.
I mean, you don't want something that's light enough to blow away by the breeze going by. But then again, you don't want something so heavy that you need two hands to hold it up.
Exactly, yeah. And the same thing with a journal. You don't want a journal where the binding is so tight that you can't lay it flat. And you're using your elbows to keep it down.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's all the prep. That kind of preparation is really important. And then, you know, getting yourself in a writing space, having some rituals, whether it's lighting a candle, going for a walk, meditating, you know, doing jumping jacks, having a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, whatever grounds you and reminds you this is the moment. And then then the next step too would be becoming self-aware, doing all kinds of self-awareness exercises. Step three is speaking your truth, and we spoke a little bit about that in terms of your emotional truth and using your authentic voice. Your authentic voice is a voice that you're speaking from your heart, not necessarily from your mind, because if we're speaking from our mind or our brain, we're writing what we think we should write as opposed to what our heart's telling us we want to write. Because, and a lot of it has to do with courage. You know, if we're afraid someone's going to read it, we're probably going to write from our head, not from our heart. And then I talk about memory a lot in that same step, because that's, you know, memory's fallible.
I mean,
it's just, you know, it's just, there's no right or wrong memory. It's just there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then a big section of the book is about examining your life, because the whole idea of bliss, people have asked, so what is bliss? Well, I believe bliss is following the path that you were meant to follow and the path that makes your heart sing. And so examining your life is all a part of that. Are you doing what you want to do? Are you doing what you think your parents want or your spouse wants or society wants you to do? Yeah. And you might be miserable in that path. So it's all about examining where you're at. I also talk a lot about reading, because in order to be a writer, you need to be a good reader. So there's a big appendix at the back of the book listing really great memoirs that you can read about other people's lives and biographies so that you can get inspired.
Okay.
And then step five is finding your form, and that's whether you either want to do journaling or you want to do a memoir or you want to do poetry. So you have to think about what genre you feels comfortable for you. I also talk about the different kinds of journals, whether it's gratitude journals, travel journals, or just a regular journal. Then I talk about essays as well. Let's see. Then I added a chapter that a lot of these books don't have, and it's about poetry, because a lot of people, especially my generation, we were very intimidated by poetry because we were exposed to Chaucer and Shakespeare. It's like, this is really cool, but I have no idea what they're talking about. It's like, he's really talented, but what is he really
saying?
Yeah, what's he saying? You know? So the way I teach poetry in my chapter called Unleashing with Poetry is really just, it's very accessible. It's like coming up with an image, coming up with a thought, and then taking it from there. And poetry is used by a lot of therapists in conjunction with therapy, and it really is very, very useful.
The struggle that I have with poetry, and I know that there was a section in a course that I took in grade school where we had to memorize a poem. And I often hear people constantly say, oh, yes, I remember this poem that I learned in third grade or eighth grade or whatever. I couldn't tell you what the poem was. I could not. But it never resonated with me. I could never quite. And it had nothing to do with like Shakespeare, because I can listen to Shakespeare.
Right.
Matter of fact, we went and saw Twelfth Night on stage in Solvang and at the Outdoor Theater, which was wonderful. I may not have understood every single word and or phrase, but as I'm listening and watching, I'm getting the context
mm-hmm.
because I'm understanding the other words around it, and I'm
right.
able to put it all together. And
right.
oh, that's what he's talking. Okay, gotcha. I
yeah.
see.
Yeah.
And so you listen long enough.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that one scene in the old Bill Cosby series that where his son's friend where they had to learn Macbeth.
Yeah.
And so they got an album. And they're listening to the album. It's a dramatized.
Yeah.
The hurly burly. And I'm going, okay, yeah. it's out of context, but, you know, that isn't going to work for you. You've got to read it. Never. So for me, poetry would be, that would be a real challenge.
Mm.
So I probably wouldn't go there unless somehow I could find a way of.
I'll drag you through it.
Okay.
Read that chapter.
Okay, I will.
And again, the best way to start is to read poets that resonate with you. Like
yeah.
Billy Collins is a great poet. You know, he just, because he talks about, you know, everyday things that happen to us, you know.
Yeah.
He's got one great poem called Forgetfulness, which is just, we all start forgetting. And it's just, it's a funny poem. He's got a poem about, you know, his parents and just things, real things that happen. And in a voice that, it's the voice that's yeah. really what compels us.
If we take a look, for example, at the lyrics of a song, those, the way they're written especially, those are, in essence, poems.
Oh, yes.
They're put to music,
oh,
in a
yes.
manner of speaking.
Oh, yes.
So really, we do have a connection with poetry, whether we realize it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the late Leonard Cohen, he was a fabulous poet. I mean, he has some books of poetry out, and his lyrics were phenomenal, and I actually listen to him sometimes when I'm writing. He inspires me.
Mm.
Yes, a very close connection, if you can understand the words. Sometimes we can't.
What's really disheartening to me these days, here I am in my late 50s, and I'm listening to some of the songs I used to listen to in my teens, 20s, and 30s. Oh, that was the word he was saying, you know. And I'm going, how could I have gone on for 40 years
yeah.
and not known that that was the word? It wasn't that hard yeah. to hear what was in my way at the time, kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I have that with Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, LSD. Now I get it. Back then, I might have been taking too much. I don't know.
But it's, I know that it's one of the struggles that we all have. I mean, there are songs that even to this day, we still don't. And they've tried to analyze them.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah. we're not sure even what that word is.
Yeah.
We understand the pronunciation, but what is that?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going to promote phones, but I will say that the iPhone now, Mac Music or, but anyway, they have the lyrics as you're listening to them. And I think that's just fabulous.
Wow.
I love that because it helps.
Yeah. Well, now I
as a word master like I am.
Well, I do the same thing now. Well, because I have an Android, but I will go to a lyrics website and say, okay, I'm looking for the lyrics for this song. And then I'll start reading down the lyrics. And again,
yeah.
I'll see that one phrase and oh, that was the word. Unbelievable. That's what it sounds like, but how come I didn't hear it? And that's
exactly.
That's the other thing we hear. You know, you talked about, our memories are selective and sometimes flawed.
Yes.
Well, our hearing, and I've known that in the radio business for years, that people listening to the radio hear what they want to hear.
Because
we'll get phone calls saying, why don't you talk about this? Or why did you say that? Or, well, we didn't. Or they will call up asking for a particular person who's doing a particular show, but not on this station. For some reason, they've called us wanting to talk to this person.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have that person on this station.
Yeah.
So, but that's just human nature.
Human nature. We hear what we want to hear.
Yeah,
for sure. And so the final step is sharing your writing, which is all about publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not for everyone. It just depends, you know.
And to that end, I know that there's self-publishing now.
Mm-hmm.
I know there are still some publishing companies that are very selective because they don't want to take very big risks because, hey, you know, supposedly it can get very expensive. But in terms of, for example, the 9 books that you've written, are you going through a publishing company?
Yes, all of them.
How did that start for you in your first book?
You really want to know? well, my first book was interesting because I have 3 kids and I was on bed rest with all of them. And so my first book was all about difficult pregnancies. And it was published in the late 80s. I typed it on a typewriter.
Manual or electric?
Manual.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was, my husband's an engineer, and so he built me this table over my bed, and there I was typing my book. And so I ended up self-publishing that one because I couldn't get a publisher that was interested. I sold 10,000 copies from my basement. It was like basement. It was like remarkable. Wow. When I was living in Canada.
Yeah.
But then when the publisher saw the sales, and I was able to sell to a publisher, so then it went to a mainstream publisher. But the rest of my books are all through publishers. You know, a lot of people are self-publishing, and I just warn them, not against it, but just to be mindful of two things. And one is, if you're going to self-publish, make sure you get a good editor. Because if there's typos throughout your book, it really discredits your voice, discredits what you're saying. And number two is, you have to be really good at marketing. Mm. Because it's great for your ego having a book with your name on it, on your desk. But if it doesn't get out to the world, what's the point?
Exactly.
So you have to have either a good marketing team or know how to market it yourself. And I think one of my strengths is I'm a really good marketer. And I love it. I love sending my book out. I love doing interviews. I like writing about my book. And so that's been good for me. But I, you know, I'm lucky. In that way.
Yeah, it reminds me of an old Stan Friedman.
Most writers aren't. Most writers just want to sit and write. They don't want to market their book. So, which sometimes I feel that too. I'm like, I'm over this. I'm like, tired of talking about bliss. Can I get back to writing?
Yeah,
no,
right.
But I love it. I love sharing my passion for writing. So sorry I didn't interrupt you.
No, that's right. You have a real diverse and very broad personal appeal in regards to the things that you enjoy doing. Whereas a lot of us, we get into doing something that just really works well for us and really don't want to do much of anything else. We really enjoy doing that. Almost along the lines of, I don't want to talk about this anymore. I want to go back to writing.
Mm-hmm.
Or I want to go back to gardening or whatever it is that our passion is, which is what we're trying to get people towards. And when you talk about this whole aspect of telling our story, in respect to transforming one's life, we have people on here who are constantly talking about that element of, as I put it, transforming from survival to thrive. I almost said thrival.
That's a great word, by the way. It's a sign of genius when you can invent your own words, by the way.
I'll give it a shot. Thrival. But we want to, that's where we want to, from my perspective, at least at this point in our evolution, that's the next step.
Mm-hmm.
Enough with surviving. I've had it. I don't want to survive anymore. I want to thrive. I want to enjoy the life that I've been given or that I created or, you know, however I got here, I'm here, accident or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we see so many people who are doing nothing but just day to day, 9 to 5, go home, get up, go to work, go
sad.
Home.
Sad,
And they get trapped in that. Mm-hmm. In 2008, when we had the big downturn in the economy, thousands and thousands of people were laid off, right? They were let go from their jobs. And the first thing that went through my mind was, I wonder how many of those people hated the job they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember hearing shortly thereafter, within the next couple of years, that there were more people who were now pursuing entrepreneurial ventures than ever before. And most of those people had lost their jobs in the downturn. And maybe now they were doing that which they really wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And you've heard this before, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
if a child wants to go into the arts, and usually the more practical father's going to say, there's no money in the arts. You need to have some backup of accounting or welding or something that can earn you money. And yet on this program, I hear constantly, if you pursue your purpose, the money will follow. And I think that there needs to be a change to that phrase, not because the money won't follow, but because we think that it's going to come in a specific way. And then when it doesn't come in that specific way, I now have 3, 4, 5, 6 places before the decimal point in my bank account, okay? When it doesn't come that way, we're disappointed, like, oh, it didn't work. I guess I better go back to welding or go back to accounting because this drawing or this journaling or this writing or this sculpting or dancing or singing, whatever it is, it's just not paying off. And apparently I'm not. And then, of course, we start being self-critical. I'm not good enough, obviously, because I'm not at the top of the top of the pile kind of thing.
Well, it's also being obsessed with the numbers, too. I mean, there is some truth in the fact, and I agree, maybe we should change the phrase, there is some truth in the fact that when you're passionate about something and you love doing something, you can put all you have into it. So oftentimes, not always, when you put all you have into something, then the results are positive. Yeah. But, you know, what is the saying about risks? No risk, no gain. I mean, so you're probably going to have to risk something, whether it's living less luxuriously during your transition until you make it to the place you want. And
I also hear the phrase, if you just work hard. And I sometimes think, how much harder do I have to work? I mean, my gosh, I'm working, some people are going, I'm working 8, 10, 12, 14, 16 hours, 18 hours a day. I'm working 2 jobs. I'm working 3 jobs.
Yeah, especially in Santa Barbara, we work, a lot of people have to have a few jobs.
Yeah. Well, when I first moved here, that was the comment that was made to me. And I certainly do side jobs, little things on the side for people, that kind of stuff. But I have one main job.
Sure.
And so I'm lucky in
that
respect.
That's your passion job, right?
It is. Yeah. It's part of it. It's part of it. I mean, certainly there are parts I would like to, give to someone else. I've even asked, I've even had people that I've worked with, they've been around me long enough, and I say to them, so how would you feel if, if they gave the job to you? Not a chance. I wouldn't want your job, I wouldn't even pay you to do your job. Okay.
That's funny.
Because it's rather involved. I mean, quite honestly, I'm doing the work of 2 or 3 different people, but I have been able to organize it in such a way to where it's just become routine for me.
Sure.
But I know that just finding one's purpose, finding one's passion, for a lot of folks is really, really hard.
Journaling is important for that, though, because
that'll help.
When you journal, there's all kinds of things that would help, but you're right. But when you journal, you really are tapping into your subconscious mind, especially if you're doing what we call stream of consciousness journaling, where you take your journal, take your pen, and you write for 15 or 20 minutes without lifting your pen off the page. You could start out by writing, I'm having a really awful day. And by the end, and the great thing about journaling is there's no beginning and end. It goes wherever your mind goes. So you can say, I'm having a really awful day. And then all of a sudden, by the bottom of the page, you realize, I can't wait to go to Ireland next year. And so, and that's beautiful. That's the beautiful thing about journaling. And then when you go back and you read it, you can have all kinds of things revealed to you about perhaps you're not living your life purpose, how you could, head down that path and all kinds of ideas like that. So journaling is very valuable.
When was the first time you actually sat down and just started writing journaling? Not so much a book, but did that start very early for you?
Yes. Well, journaling has been part of my life for over 50 years. I started writing really like letter writing when I was sent to sleepaway camp. I'd write letters home, but journaling started when I was 10. My grandmother was my caretaker and she was looking after me and she committed suicide in my childhood home. And it wasn't brutal. It was an overdose of sleeping pills, but nevertheless, I found her. My parents were at work. My mother was an English major and she was dealing with her own loss of losing her mother. And so she went out to the store and bought me a Cahill Gibram journal. And she said, all I can tell you is just write your feelings down, write about your grandma. So I would sit for hours on end writing. And that was the beginning of my understanding and belief that writing can be healing and transformative. There were quotes on top of each page from him, which kind of sparked, because when you're 10, you're like, how do I start? They kind of sparked my own thought process. And so it started then, and then I realized the healing power of writing. And when I became a teenager, I was going through the angst of adolescence, I wrote more than went through, difficult pregnancies, I wrote more. 2 cancer diagnoses, I wrote more. So every time I'm not saying I just write about the negative things. I also write about happy things going on. I do gratitude journaling, but it's been a part of my life for a long time.
Do you have any of those older journals?
I wish I did. My mother, when she moved from my childhood home, she's not a hoarder. She tosses out things. She has this rule that she tosses out anything that she's not used in a year, and so that was my journals were part of that.
Ouch.
So, ouch is right. So, my journals only go back, you know, I don't know. I guess I would journal like crazy in 2001 for sure, because when I had my cancer diagnosis, and I was diagnosed with cancer a few weeks right before 9/11. It was just was a very intense year. Yeah, so I have my adult journals. Yeah.
That's interesting because my wife was diagnosed July.
Oh.
Between the 16th and the 18th. And then she had her surgery on August 10th, I believe it was. Mm. And she was going through chemo during that period of time. So she doesn't remember a lot of that because the chemo just is... Mm. I wouldn't wish that stuff on my worst enemy. I got to tell you, it's bad stuff. But it's interesting, the similarities.
Yeah.
This whole process is something that we all can do this. And I was starting to go in my mind through the different... and I still have the very first one that I started in, and I can't remember if I bought it for me or someone bought it for me. Mm-hmm. Sort of gold embossed on the cover, and I would try to use if I could, even if I just to I don't know to break things up, different colors of ink. You know,
beautiful.
But it is kind of fascinating to go back and look and see and also see the spaces between.
True.
Of course, now it's been probably 10 or 12 years, if not
that's
more.
That's a big space. What's he been doing all those years?
Yeah. The first entry will be, it's been almost
busy.
Almost like confessional. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I haven't journaled in 42 years. When you are giving these workshops, when you are facilitating these workshops and people come in and they're going to start to share with you their experiences.
Sure.
Certainly you have those opportunities for people to do that. Do you find that most people have been journaling and just need a little boost? Or how about those people who come in there and never journaled a day in their lives?
There's a big mix, actually. I think most of the people have journaled at one point in their lives, perhaps like yourself. They started and stopped, and they need some inspiration to get going. And so we get a good mix in those. And about the sharing, I always make it very clear as soon as people come into my workshop is kind of, I don't want to use the word Vegas right now, but I have to in this context, and that is... whatever happens in this room stays in this room,
kind of thing.
Like,
right.
I don't, it's private. Some people have some really painful stories.
You make a safe space.
I make it very painful stories that they share verbally, and then they're kind of asking for validation. Is it okay to write about this?
Yeah.
And I say, sure, you can write about whatever you want to write about. And so, and there's emotionally, for some people, it's very hard. And so I work a lot on courage.
Mm.
When I had my first cancer diagnosis, my father-in-law, who's a Holocaust survivor, the first thing he said to me was, have no fear. And I think that was a sticky I had on my computer for a long time, for writing, for life, because if we live in fear, we don't get a lot done, and we stress ourselves out.
Yeah. You have a book called Writing on the Edge.
Yes, I do.
And what it made me think of is the work
Sitting on a ledge?
Something like that, yes. Trying to figure out when I'm going to finish my book.
Ah.
I've been working on a book from that period of 2001 since then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 16 years. And it's not a big book. It's not War and Peace, which, by the way, I'm considering getting an Audible form, but I want to get it the unabridged version.
Yeah.
Because I hear references all the time, and I'm going, I haven't read that one.
Yeah.
I have to say Audible has been great.
They've been great.
Because it allows me. I'm actually in the middle of A Stranger in a Strange Land.
Oh, great.
My favorite word is to grok. And grokking.
Yeah.
And people are like, what does that mean? It's to assimilate. It's to completely and utterly assimilate into your being the understanding of that which you're experiencing. And it's not just, oh, I get that. No. It's so much more than that. And it's interesting that it is a, at least from the context of the book, it's a Martian term, certainly. Mm. I remember I was actually all the way up to, I think it was chapter 32, and I'm going, I don't even remember how I got here. So I went right back to chapter 23, mm-hmm. which is where I do remember, mm-hmm. and I'm starting over again. I don't know how I spaced all of this off. I must have been doing something else and not focused. Mm-hmm. But I love it because as a kid growing up, being legally blind, I was a client of Talking Books and Recordings for the Blind.
Yes.
And then I went to work. My very first radio job was for Sun Sounds Radio Reading Service for the Blind and Visually Impaired in Phoenix, where they read the newspapers, magazines, books, periodicals, all of the printed materials, and it was provided on a closed circuit service. Now, if you wanted to go to sunsounds.org, you could listen to what they're doing. And I know they have them in California, and they're all over the country. Mm-hmm. And I remember getting into a little bit of a debate with my second manager at a Christian radio station, and the subject in Congress came up of defunding the printing of the Playboy magazines in Braille. I was like,
why would they do that?
Why would you defund that? Why would you stop? Now, on the business side, I'd say, look, if Hefner, bless his heart and soul, if he wants to provide the Braille to the blind and visually impaired at newsstand price, then let him do that. From a business standpoint, we shouldn't be paying for it. Mm-hmm. But from the other standpoint of, you're saying that you don't want that made available. Mm-hmm. What you were telling to this particular segment of our society is that you are going to decide what they can and cannot read.
Right.
You can go into any bookstore and look, and I might go into a bookstore. I'll just look at the spine. Yeah, look at that. I don't want to read that. Or I'll pull it down. I might flip through it. And maybe I will read this one. You get to do that. They don't. Why do you have the right to tell them what they can or cannot read? It was one of the only arguments I ever won with him.
Oh, good for you. I agree.
You know? Yeah. And so when it comes to our own writing, we almost have to take that same perspective and what you were talking about before in terms of being honest and truthful as you're writing. Mm-hmm. And maybe that, what was it, the... I for whatever reason, I've blown the phrase that the continuous writing where you don't lift the pen from the paper.
Oh, yes. Stream of consciousness.
Stream of consciousness. Yeah. That might be, and you almost, you have to sort of be in a meditative state or anything of that nature, or you just
You get into it. It brings you into
zone.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so two of my books actually are available on Audible. One is Writers in Their Notebooks. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I think I went up, there's a studio in Goleta, right? Where they used,
there used to be.
They used to be.
The recordings for
name?
The blind and dyslexic.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I went up there and recorded that one there. And then my other book, Lust, is also in Audible. But I agree. I mean, everything should be available. Actually, I met a woman at a going away party last night, and she heard about my book, and she has retrolental fibroplasia, I believe.
Wow.
And she's like, I want to read your book, but I can't, so can you get it on Audible? And I don't know if people who are legally blind, maybe you can help me out with this, maybe it's a discussion for after, but whether this would be good for them, because I don't know if they'd be able to use any of the prompts, and I mean, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Well, I will tell you this. In addition to my own history, my first marriage, I was married to a woman who's totally blind.
Wow.
And at first she used a cane, and then she shifted to guide dogs. And we would go to movies. She did not, for the most part, she did not have a problem with those verbal cues that referred to, you see what I'm talking about? If we were having a conversation, that phrase might come up. It was not a big deal.
Right.
I've even made jokes even about myself where I'm a native Phoenician. I was born and raised in Phoenix, Arizona.
Right.
And I was also born legally blind. I'm a Phoenician blind. and of course, it depends upon the temperament of each individual.
Right.
But my feeling is, you know, if you can't laugh at yourself and your circumstances, then, you know, we need to work on that.
Yeah, we do. Laughter is definitely in short supply.
It really is.
And and bliss.
Absolute bliss. In terms of this whole business of moving on with a work, whether it's your journaling, which we've really talked about a lot, which is great, but in terms of, let's just say, okay, I've got this story idea, in my case, 16 years old, that I really want to get down.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't have the time. I mean, my work schedule is this, and my home life is this, and we're doing this and this and this. And again, I'm putting all of this stuff, and I actually read a thing on the internet the other day about the five reasons why we don't.
Yeah.
And I read those five and going, yeah, okay, all five.
Guilty.
Help me.
Yeah.
In terms of getting, because that's what the title said to me, writing on the edge. I'm on the edge. I'm almost there,
right.
But I can't quite get over it.
Well, let me just clarify that the book Writing on the Edge is a compilation of essays that I edited. It's not my own writing, about writers who use writing for healing, like very well-published writers, and they've written essays where they've been battling all kinds of addictions, everything from drug to alcohol, sex, gambling, all those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And so, back to your original question, you know, we all have priorities.
Yeah.
And so if writing is something you really want to do, you know, get up half an hour early in the morning and do it.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, there's always time to do what we want to do is always my answer to that question. So there you have
it. That's a good point. That's a good point. That goes along with what they told me in one of these in the program I went through in the 80s. With those who were resistant in the first night or two. And they basically, boy, this irritated a lot of people. If you didn't want to be here, you wouldn't be here. You are here, so that must mean you want to be here.
Brilliant.
So get in the program.
Get with it.
Nobody left. Nobody left.
Nobody left. No.
Nobody left.
But they went home and thought about it, and they remembered this many years later.
Yeah, and they came back.
Yeah, they came back.
It was quite interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was 21 when I went through the first program, and it opened up some very interesting experiences for me after that.
I bet.
The first program that I won't share here, but this process, I don't know. It seems to me, and I'm sure there's additional scientific evidence to prove the. I mean, it's almost as if you talked about the essays in the book Writing on the Edge for healing. It seems to me that it's almost like putting the dis-ease on the paper, getting out of yourself. It's almost like you get bit by a snake and you get the venom in. Well, now you got to get the venom out. And that's kind of what you're doing when you're writing it on the paper.
Yes. Yes. Very good point.
You know?
Yeah. It's a sort of release. It's cathartic. It's and sometimes that's all people need. You know, there's all kinds of therapy. There's verbal therapy and written therapy. So for those that are in verbal therapy, this is a good, you know, augmentation to, if they've gone through something difficult, to whatever therapy they're undergoing. And in terms of writing a memoir, you know, you're right. Most of the people in my classes are 40 and up, because what do you have to write about when you're 20? Unless you've had some trauma, you know, unless you had a birth, you know, issue that you're coming to terms with or whatever. So there are situations, but for the most part, because the thing about memoir is, and I should probably clarify the difference between a memoir and a biography. A memoir has got a theme in it, so you might want to, you know, write about a life experience that you've had. Would be a memoir. It would not include all the tidbits about every aspect of your life, your family, but the theme would be, let's just talk about blindness, if you will. So I was born legally blind, and this is how I've lived my life, and I'm successful. I'm a radio producer. And so that would be, the theme would be the legal blindness.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, it was, you know, I've had a lot of losses in my life, so my memoir was, you know, about the losses in my life, and so losses of very dear loved ones. So... And a biography is about a whole life. It's about starting at birth and going through, you know, all the marriages, all the kids, all the dramas. And it's, you know, it doesn't really have a theme except life.
Yeah.
So, and that's basically the difference.
You know, I had the opportunity to interview my parents a couple of years ago.
Oh, great.
And
how'd that go?
Well, it was interesting because I had to divorce myself from being their son to being the interviewer, that was an interesting challenge in and of itself. But I remember I asked my dad a particular question. It was a little bit loaded in one sense. It wasn't intentional, And his response, and it was removed from the interview at his request, his response was, boy, you don't really want to go there, do you?
Oh, ouch.
Yeah. Now, it wasn't so much a sore spot as much as I was asking for some kind of comparison. I've got a brother and four sisters, and I was asking for some kind of comparison, compare and contrast kind of question, I guess it was. And he says, you really don't want to go there, do you? You know, because he wasn't. He was not going there.
I was
going
to say, he just shut you down.
He did. And that was okay.
Yeah.
Because this was their interview, and I wasn't going to, you know, if we went somewhere, they didn't want to go. But then again, they shared with me great stories about friendships and about music and about having a family, a big family, and about growing up in their small towns that they did in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And so on and so forth. And it was really interesting. And then that what, you know, you mentioned the biography. Mm-hmm. I know there's biography and autobiography. And obviously auto is I write mine.
Exactly.
Whereas I love when I hear the phrase, and this is an unauthorized biography. I thought, but you've never heard the phrase unauthorized autobiography.
You know, right.
I'm thinking, okay, maybe someone with a split personality could write an unauthorized autobiography.
Right.
That would be interesting.
That's funny,
But I just found that conversation, and I've said this before on the program, that my parents, they are my parents, but I don't see them that way anymore. They're they're really, really good friends. And by the way, you talked about thank you notes.
Yes.
I will send my father something on his birthday, or Father's Day, my mother, Mother's Day, and her birthday, and they're all May, June, May, June, August, and September. And within a week to 10 days, I will get a little envelope in the mail from both of, from each of them, a handwritten thank you note.
Oh, lovely.
My parents still do that. And my dad does it in cursive. And I think he and I have similar handwriting.
Oh, interesting.
But he does it.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Beautiful.
And they're in their 80s.
That's great.
And they're doing fantastic.
That's fabulous.
And so I think about this aspect. You know, you talk about, you know, I'm not even sure how I would approach it. It would obviously come from my perspective of a, not so much an autobiography of self, but of family and the experiences that I remember growing up and so forth before I moved out and on and on and on.
Right.
Do you have people that do that kind of thing, or is that too big of a risk because now you're writing about other people and they're real close to you? It's almost as if, okay, I have to wait for everybody to die before I can publish this.
That's what ends up happening very often.
Yeah.
You know, I use the example, and I've used the example in here about Maxine Kong Kingston. She wrote a book called The Woman Warrior. She was an Asian American woman, and if you've not read the memoir, it's great. But basically, she had a family secret, and she couldn't write about it till everyone passed. And the family secret was that her aunt committed suicide in China because she had an illegitimate child. And that was like, ooh, no, no, no.
Wow.
Still is no, no, no in a lot of places. But so she finally was able to write the memo, but that happens very often. So what I tell people is, because sometimes you're darn, I want to write it now. So just write it. You
write
can write it now.
Need to publish it.
You hide it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then don't publish it until everyone's passed.
Put it in a steel trapped envelope.
Exactly.
Give it to an attorney and say, once everybody's died on this list, then you can send it to Simon and Schuster.
Exactly. Exactly. And so actually, that reminds me. Yeah, they are. So what I used to do, because I was so afraid of people copying my stuff, one way to copyright your own is supposedly when you write it, it's already copyrighted, but I never believed that. So if you write a first draft of a book, you mail it to yourself and keep it in a sealed envelope.
Because it's going to have the stamp.
That's right.
The postmark.
Exactly.
I've heard that about books. I've heard that about other things as well, other documents, you know, that you want to preserve.
Sure.
Or like trade names and trademarks and those kinds of things.
Exactly.
And that will do it. And you take it to court. And, here, Your Honor. And he opens it because he sees the postmark. There you go. Very, very interesting. I want to thank you so much for sharing with us and coming in studio. This has been fantastic. A couple things. Number one is, if you are interested in putting some of your other works into an audible format, a recorded format, listenable format. I do that kind of thing.
Oh, cool.
All right. Number two is the folks who want to get in touch with you, would they just go through the website?
Sure, that's the best way.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And it is dianarabb.com. That's dianarabb.com.
Right. And there's an events page. Anyone that's interested in, you know, any of my writing workshops is on there as well. And if we want me to come to your community and teach a writing workshop, you can contact me through there.
And the second thing is that I've got three final questions to ask you before we wrap up. And again, I thank you so much for coming in
my
and
pleasure.
Talking with
thank
us.
Thank you. This is great.
First question is, who is Diana Rabb?
Oh, ouch. What you see is what you get. I've been called authentic. Actually, someone called me yesterday and said, I figured out who you are. You're a merging of Natalie Goldberg and the Dalai Lama. And I went, wow, no. But anyway, Natalie Goldberg she's a Zen writing teacher, very famous, and I was very honored. But I don't know, did I give you the answer you want? I am who I am.
Okay.
My bio's on my website.
There you go. All right. We can send people to dianarabb.com. Second question is, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I want to share my passion for writing so that everyone, because I believe everyone has a story, and I believe they should get it on paper.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
My life's purpose is writing, and my second life's purpose is teaching others to write. And I know this because when I feel happiest is when I'm writing and when I'm teaching others to write. Because I think that's what bliss is. Like, when do you feel happiest?
Diana Rabb, thank you again for joining
us. Thank you so much for having me, Richard.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Website, once again, is dianarabb.com. That's dianarabb.com. We will be linked to her website as well. Until next time, love to Lal.